Hey, hey, welcome back to the Terry Summers podcast. I am so tickled to have you with me for another episode. You know, lately I have been trying to practice carrying myself more gracefully. And that's been like a physical effort that I have been pursuing. But my next guest has had an effect on my life with that word gracefully that I hope you're ready for. Hey, how was that for a teaser? Yes, I have been working on carrying myself gracefully, just aware of posture and things like that. But my understanding of the word grace has been so informed by my next guest. If you know me, you likely know, and if you don't, I'll make it clear now that I have for nearly all my life been a Jesus follower. I have a relationship that is anchored in Jesus, and in and through that, I have used my gifts in communicating, comedy, etc., to share the love of God through Jesus over the course of my lifetime, my adult life in particular. And I had an opportunity, as you will learn about, to connect with a gentleman who has now been my friend for nearly 30 years, Tim Wright. And he is monumental to me for the reason I just shared. He gave me a clarity of the word grace in my 20s that expanded my understanding of my faith and how I wished to live my faith out with those around me and also just beyond those that I know. He also is so smart, and he is a great communicator, and he wrestles with things like you and I do. He is a pastor, and I know as soon as we put that on people, sometimes we immediately feel a separation, and that's sort of unfair, I think, to folks like Tim, because he is right there with us in his living out his faith. He's an author. He has some great insights, and he has just helped me through introducing me and expanding my understanding of faith. He has helped me learn how to live with others in love. And you're going to find him to be so articulate and full of really interesting insights. Whether or not you agree with everything, whether or not you come from a faith-based perspective, there is grace in this conversation, not to mention knowledge and wisdom. So I sure hope you love him like I do. Here he is.
Hello, my friend, Tim. I'm recording. I told you I'd let you know, and I did.
I see it on my screen, so thank you.
Awesome. Oh, you do? So see, you've educated me.
Yep.
I didn't know that. I thought I rested in power.
Yep, you do rest in power. I just see that it's recording. so that will let me know that someone's listening in on me.
Yes. Uh-huh. I have an intro that I do in all my podcasts where I sort of explain who I'm getting ready to talk to. And you have been a friend of mine since 1990. I didn't say this. I'm counting back now. 1992.
Wow.
Yeah. And I met you at Community Church of Joy. You were an associate pastor at that time? Yep. Yes. Mm-hmm. And you now pastor a church that came out of that time at Community Church of Joy. Can you tell us a little bit about your church that I also, I worked at Community Church of Joy, and then you also invited me to come with you to your church now. But why don't you tell me a little bit about your church?
Sure. Well, I was at Community Church of Joy for 22 years. And that's, as you said, that's where we met. And then back in 2004, I felt God was nudging me to start a new church, not because I had problems at Joy. I just sensed God wanted to do something new in my life and in a new church. And so with the blessing of Community Church of Joy, we started Community of Grace Lutheran Church in March of 2005. And it was quite a different experience because we went from a multi-million dollar campus where we had every program you can imagine to now doing church in a school once a week for a couple hours. And so it meant rethinking how we do church, meant looking at new ways to do church. We were fortunate in that some land had been purchased for a new church to be started or built on that land, and that land was given to us. So we were really blessed with a very special gift to be able to build early on. The challenge for us is we started our church right when the recession hit. So, you know, to start a new church, we started with nothing, and then to have to build up and then be hit by a recession really forced us to have to trust God. And we did, and we were able to build the campus in the middle of the recession. And we brought Terry Summers on our staff right away. And then she left us to go pursue other things like podcasts and TV shows and acting. And so, you know, in the last 15 years or so, we've just slowly been growing in terms of our understanding of mission and ministry. And we're at a point right now, I think, like a lot of churches, where this pandemic has really changed everything. And it's giving us an opportunity to step back and say, all right, God, what does it look like to be the church now after a pandemic, when all of our lives have been turned upside down, when things probably won't go back to normal anytime soon, and where we have seen once again the instability racially in our country and the inequalities. And do we stand at a moment in this time where we have to say, okay, enough's enough, and rather than just lip service, to do something really significant about that. So I think there are a lot of churches really wrestling, and ours is one of them, with what does it look like to be the church now and into the future after really everything's been turned upside down.
And just to back up a hair, because I think that, you know, you I don't want to say have cornered the market on some things, or at least led the way. When I met you, one of the reasons I even came to Community Church of Joy is we had a mutual friend that let you know that I was someone working in town on a show called Gub, an actress that also did a lot of speaking to youth and what have you. And I believe it was that your youth department there at Community Church of Joy invited me to come speak at a winter retreat. And then we had an exchange, but all of that leading up to the fact that you sort of led the pack, I think, back in the day, because that was a bit of a while ago, in being innovative in the way that our message is shared, a message is shared. And the arts was and is terribly important to you. Can you talk about that? Because I do think it can dovetail even into how you are kind of reinventing yourself even as a leader of a congregation and of as a ministry in this time. But how do you see the arts fitting in, and how did they fit in then and now?
Well, I'm a part of the Lutheran denomination, and the Lutheran denomination is what we would call liturgical. So if you think of a Catholic church with pastors or priests in that case wearing robes and chanting music, that's really the tradition that I came out of. But as I was growing up, I'm 62 years old, so I was raised in a rock and roll era. And the kind of music that we were listening to on the radio was not church music or organ music. And so young Christian people, as I was back then, who had musical abilities, began to take the music that we were listening to and reconfigure it with language or words that shared the message that we believed as followers of Jesus. And so it sort of gave rise to what we call Jesus music, or later on it was called contemporary Christian music. And we began to introduce that into the church. When I was a kid, we did that when we would just travel in a band and we would go to, and do these concerts. But then when I came to Community Church of Joy, they were already experimenting with some more contemporary forms of worship or music. And I had the opportunity, because of the senior pastor I worked with, Walt Callistead, who just really believed in what we were doing, just gave us permission to really experiment. And so we were kind of involved in what at that time was called the worship wars. Can you use rock and roll music or pop music in church? And there were many people who were used to singing Bach and Beethoven and Luther and classical music and hymns and said, no, you can't. And their churches weren't reaching a lot of new families. But the churches that were using new forms of music, and then the arts like drama, once screens came available, doing stuff on screens, all of that together to create a holistic experience where you sort of have your story that you want to tell that week. Terry comes along and she writes a drama. We pick music that fits that. The sermon fits that. We used all of that together.
Yes.
To create every week an experience that was somewhat like theater in the sense that we had a through line to the service. And for a number of years, the church that I was at least in Lutheran, Episcopalian, Presbyterian churches, we were kind of one of the churches that people would look to.
Right.
And so I often refer to those days as that was back when I was Tim Wright. And, you used to be Tim Wright, didn't you? Yeah, that was me. And but now the church we're doing, we still use arts, but not quite in the same way in terms of our worship service. But we still use arts a lot in the things that we surround the service. We do a Disney show every year. We do a Christmas show every year. We've got youth doing dramatic things. You're involved with some of that. So even though our worship services don't necessarily have like drama in them anymore, we're still using screens. We're still thinking through a storyline, but we're using arts more around the worship service, just because times have changed a little bit and what we're trying to accomplish has changed a little bit.
So in the time that we're in right now, where we aren't gathering shoulder to shoulder under right. the same roof, how are you using the platform or the medium, I guess, of the screen to help you?
Yeah. We were actually doing online worship before the pandemic hit, but basically what we were doing was showing one of our worship services. And so the service wasn't created at all for the screen. It was basically taking a service created for a live audience and just showing it. We made the decision to go online and stop doing in-house worship on a Friday. And so we had from Friday to Saturday to figure out what we were doing. So at that point, our first service was like March 14th, 15th, something like that. We just did the worship service without an audience. And we tried that for a couple weeks, and we just had the sense this isn't quite working. It's not a service made for TV. We consulted with a mutual friend, Brian Canary, and we were looking at some other churches who were doing more recorded kind of stuff. And we were a little nervous about that because it doesn't quite seem as authentic. But we experimented, so we would do a little bit of recording and a little bit of live. And what we found was a job and being more true to ourselves when we could pre-record music and do the sermon live, do communion live, some other things. Just because we can mix the sound better, it's a better sense of who we are. We took a service that usually goes 55 to 60 minutes, and we're trying to get it down to 30 minutes.
Love it.
There are a lot of churches, you know, still going hour, hour and a half, but I watch our services and I watch my sermons that are 8 to 10 minutes, and yeah, that's long enough, because it's TV and it's just a different feel. And then throughout the week, then every day of the week at 6 o'clock in the evening, we have a prayer time, or we'll do a Bible study one night, or we'll do 20 to 30 minutes of congregational singing, so to speak, online. So it's not that we don't have all those things, but we're just not doing them all in one service. And I think we're sort of finding a groove. I think we need to continue to tweak and improve. And that's the great thing about our particular team is we've got people who are willing to punt, willing to try new things. And, you know, if we could fix the preachers in the sermon, and not both preachers, but me, then I think we'd have a home run. But right now we're doing the best we can. You know, they're dragging along this old guy who's 62 years old, who, you know, just this week went to an iPhone from a flip phone. So, you know, that's where we're at.
You stop it. You are, you know, you say 62, dude, you look really good for 62.
Well, thanks.
I think I could have figured out your age because I kind of know what our age difference is, but I just, it doesn't occur to me. I think you've always done such a fabulous job, and I'm not raving on you right now, or not going to, just because people are listening. You've always done a fabulous job of communicating. You are one of the best communicators I've ever known. Super smart. Before we started, before I pressed record, you were sharing some of where you're at right now, particularly in diving in and reading about racism and educating yourself. And that is also one thing about you that makes you so fresh and current, in that you aren't afraid to address. You've always been that way. Along the way, some of the things in my own life that I now carry with me came because you instigated that, either in a staff meeting or you think outside of the box. But right now, how is that for you?
Yeah.
Diving into that subject that we all kind of hold, I'm going to assume, all of us that are white anyway, or at least me and you, that we hold our breath over in fear that we don't have a good understanding.
Yeah. So, interestingly for us, back in November of last year, I had invited a gentleman that I know. He's Dr. Warren Stewart. He's the pastor of First Institutional Baptist Church down in Phoenix. It's an African-American congregation. And just as a bit of tid, we are the only state in the union that actually voted as a state to have a Martin Luther King holiday. And he was the one who spearheaded that.
Really?
So this guy really knows his stuff. He's very smart. And I invited him to our church in November to do an interview on racism. And we spent about an hour and a half talking. And he brought some of his folks over from his church, and we had folks from our church. And it was really good, but there was a lot of stuff that I just, you know, I heard it, but I wasn't sure I got it. And then when the George Floyd thing happened, I immediately got in touch with Warren, and we did a little interview together on that. And I thought, I have to learn what's going on, because I think, like a lot of people, when I would hear things like white privilege or white supremacy, I would say, well, that has nothing to do with me. And the words didn't make sense to me. My dad, for example, grew up in poverty. His father abandoned his mother and four kids. What kind of privilege is that? Well, that's not what the word means. The word, when we're talking about white privilege, basically, where someone said it well yesterday, as a white man, I wake up, I don't have to think about the color of my skin. When a black person wakes up, he or she thinks about the color of his or her skin every day. That's privilege. Someone else once said, imagine you're in a race and, you know, white people are given a head start, huge head start, and then black people are allowed to start running. And I'm going to add this in, and they have to have jump hurdles. We don't. That's privilege. It's not something that I necessarily seek out or make happen. It's something that I live in.
Got it.
Supremacy isn't so much. We always think, or at least I do, of the Ku Klux Klan, we think of white supremacists, but white supremacy is something that was baked into our DNA as a country when every single time, you know, first of all, it started when we brought slaves over and saying they're inferior, And every time we began to say, maybe they are not inferior, maybe they're equal to us, we would put laws in place only to create new laws to keep, to hold them back. And these new laws or these new loopholes continue to this day. That's white supremacy. It's not white people intentionally getting up in the morning saying, how can I lord it over black people? It's a system that benefits me, and I haven't seen it until recently. And for me, what was most helpful, I started reading a book written by an African-American author, and it was a loving book, but had some anger in it. And it was just hard for me to read that. So what I did was I went back and started watching stuff on history. And when I began to see the way that since slavery and then Reconstruction and Jim Crow laws and black codes and red line, all this stuff that I had no idea, to see that this is a system that's in place that I benefit from. And as white people, consciously or unconsciously, we get nervous when we think about having to dismantle that to make everybody equal, which is what most of us want to have happen.
If that's what we want, if we want to have it happen, why do you think we get nervous?
I think we get nervous because we think there's going to be loss. So for example, you free 4 million slaves and you suddenly say they're equal, and now those 4 million slaves have access to the same jobs white people have access to. There's just not enough work to go around. And so you begin to build in little systems, little subtle things and not so subtle things to keep them from getting work. That's just an example from years and years ago. And I think really for a lot of us as white people, we're not even really sure what we might be losing, but we have so many stereotypes in our heads that we don't even recognize as stereotypes. And as I was watching some of these things, like on this PBS special on Reconstruction, and they were showing some of the stereotypes that were created, that they're rapists and black people are rapists and they're after white women and this. And I thought, wow, I've heard that. I've had a sense of that in my own life. Not that I ever met anybody like that, but that's a story that was poured into my brain when I was a kid, not necessarily by my parents, but by the system itself.
Got it.
And so to have to be willing to give up all of those preconceived ideas and say that black people are equal to white people, which we intuitively believe in our hearts, most of us, but when it comes to reality, if it were as easy as we want to believe it is, it would have been dismantled a long, long time ago. But the system, evil systems are always hard to break. And this is an evil system that I benefited from. I won't necessarily say I promoted it because I don't know, but I have benefited from it. And those are the things I'm learning. What I haven't learned yet is, well, now what? So, and I've really tried what I've been doing with our congregation. You know, a lot of people are writing posts and they're giving their opinions and stuff. And I've tried to stay away from that. I don't think they need one more. What I've tried to do for our folks is give them resources. Watch this. Let me interview this person. Let's ask questions. I don't want to talk until I have something to say. This is the most I've said, by the way. You've pulled it out of me, Terry.
I'm writing down resources so we don't forget to come back. But just let me, if you will, just return for a second because it resonated with me and I'm not real sure I have an answer. But when you said you were reading a book by a black gentleman that was a loving book but it had some anger in it, and you hesitated mm-hmm. and stopped for a moment and started to do research in history, what do you account for the hesitation? What do you think caused that in you, particularly as you note that there was anger in it that you sensed?
Well, the anger was justifiable, right? And I think part of it was I didn't understand the history behind it.
Got it.
Okay? So it was probably not. But there were also some things in there where it was just a little bit frustrating for me. I'll give you an example. This is written by a pastor. And in our tradition as Lutherans, if we wear what we call liturgical garb, which I don't, it's a white robe. And it's to symbolize that in Christ we are forgiven. Okay? There's a verse that says, though your sins are like scarlet, they will be white as snow. And he says that that white robe is a symbol of oppression for black people. Hmm. I thought, okay, I get that. I understand that. And and how, you know, one of the reasons why my grandpa wore a black robe, by the way. And, but when I was growing up,
grandpa was a pastor.
He was a pastor. Yes. Yeah. And we would see that black robe, and I wasn't thinking about black people, but I was thinking about judges who sit on a bench, you know, and they're usually meeting out punishment. So it wasn't necessarily the warmest picture. Right. Well, now what he said was that he wears a black robe, which I get. And he said, because black is beautiful. And so I thought to myself, well, now wait a minute. If a black robe means black is beautiful, but a white robe is oppressive, I'm not sure that moves the ball down the field. There didn't seem to be an answer to that. So I got frustrated with that. And I thought, rather than being frustrated with that, I need to understand why he's saying what he's saying.
I love it.
And that's, so it wasn't him, it was me. And I think the reason why a lot of us white people are somewhat, we put the barriers up is because we hear right speaking anger, but we don't understand all the layers behind it.
Got it.
And I think a lot of people are taking it seriously. I think there are a lot of people like me who are really trying to understand it now. And what has concerned me hasn't been my African American friends. It has been white people who aren't giving other white people the chance to really wrestle with this and give white people the chance to maybe say some things that are awkward or maybe even say things that are wrong as they're trying to understand. There seems to be no grace in the discussion for white people. And being politically, I don't want to say politically correct, to being correct on this issue is the new fundamentalism. Rather than saying, okay, this guy just said something and it wasn't really correct, but I don't think he was saying it mean-spirited. I think he's just wrestling with language. And we need to give ourselves a chance to do that. Facebook is not the most forgiving of places and is not the place for debate or discussion. It needs to happen like what we're doing, where we can talk to each other.
So when you say white people are getting in the way of white people,
yes,
wrestling with things in the way as in flesh that out a little bit more.
So I may say something about racism, okay, where I may make a statement about it, and it is not fully informed. It may have a bit of ignorance about it. It may have been said wrong, and right away, white people would jump on and say, you're a racist, you're this, you're that. You should have said this, you should have said it that way. Rather than saying, can we talk more about that? I think your point is really interesting.
Yeah.
But I think you might want to say it a different way or consider this or look at this. And I don't see a lot of that all the time.
Got it.
I think there are a lot of us trying to learn language like white privilege and white supremacy. And I've seen it many times from white people who said, look, I grew up in poverty. That's not privilege. And I understand that. And so what's been helpful to me is to hear black people come alongside and say, you're right, you grew up in hardship, but you didn't have to grow up with black skin in the process. And that's what makes your life different. Or maybe privilege isn't the better word, maybe advantages. There are advantages to having white skin than black skin. And so sometimes our words trip us up, which sometimes you need words. And that's why I think we just need to do a deep dive. This history, we both know Carlotta. You've interviewed her on your show. And her mother said something really striking. She said, black history is our history. And so rather than thinking about black history, just watch the history of the United States of America, which I've been doing from a black filter, and yet it's our history of white power, white supremacy, white systems constantly stepping in the way and saying, no, we're going to hold you back. We're going to put this barrier in place. And, one of the striking things, the 13th Amendment, written Abraham Lincoln, it wasn't ratified in Mississippi until 2013. Well, holy cow. So there were systems in place. I don't think all of Mississippi is racist. They may have some challenges there, but there are systems in place that keep us from doing that. And to this day, So, that's the stuff I'm trying to learn. And I feel like our Black brothers and sisters, they're impatient, they're tired, they're saying, we've been doing this for 400 years. But I think if people are honestly trying to figure it out, they're really supportive. I just sometimes think some of us white people need to be a bit more supportive of each other, and let's get there rather than argue with each other.
Correct.
And confront each other.
You hit the nail on the head, I think, Tim, and as you usually do. You mentioned resources you've been trying to share. Do you have a few you can holler out?
Yeah, so my wife and I watched, there's a PBS series called Reconstruction, and it was amazing because it was well done. It was told with honesty and candor, interesting. That shows you how this was baked into our system, which really helped move me from it being personal, Tim, you're a racist, to we live in a racist system.
Got it.
Really helpful. There was a movie, it's on Netflix, called 13th.
Yep.
And it looks at the system through the lens of prison, and how in many ways prison became the new slavery. That's oversimplifying it, but it was a good follow-up for that. I'm reading a book right now called White Rage, which again goes through all of this. So part of what I'm trying to do is just hear it over and over again.
Right.
And I've got a book called How to Be an Anti-Racist, which I haven't started yet. And then a new one just came out, and I just got it. It's called Rediscipling the White Church. So I think that sounds fascinating to me. For those of us who
are
church business, rediscipling the white church. So, because one of the conversations is we have Black churches and we have white churches. And is that a racist thing? Is that a language thing? What's going on? Why these different churches? And so I'm fascinated with that, but I'm not there yet. I'm just trying to figure out the system first.
Well, I, as I said at the beginning before we started, that I'd love to have you back just because of who you are and how well you communicate. We could pretty much pick any topic and I could listen to you for a good long while. There is another thing I do want to bring up, so I just want to shift gears a little bit. I know you to be someone who is passionate about all people,
right.
But you have a drive about young children, boys, about seeing to the health and well-being of boys. And you've taken on that effort in, I think, a really great, widespread way. But do you want to touch base on how, and let me just add to that. I have a friend that has 5 boys, and I love her. And so knowing that you are just bent on making sure we understand what they need, has having this friendship with her has just kind of infused me with more curiosity of my own. So Can you back up, or can we back up a little bit, or would you go back to the beginnings of that and kind of bring us up to speed with all you have going on and who you work with in those arenas?
Yeah. So I got interested in what's going on with our boys when we first started the church, and it started with doing some reading. And in the process, I connected with Dr. Michael Gurian, who is a New York Times bestselling author. He's considered to be the father of the modern day boys movement. He wrote a book over 20 years ago called The Wonder of Boys. And what Michael does is he uses brain science research, and all the brain scans, everything tells us that for the majority, boys' brains are wired differently than girls' brains. There's over 150 differences between a female brain and a male brain. Now, we share a lot of things in common, but there are a lot of things that are different. And I'm overgeneralizing, but one of the things we know, for example, is that boys tend to learn differently than girls. Girls tend to learn more verbally, more emotively. Boys tend to learn more from action and visually. And part of what I learned years ago was one of the untold stories is back in the 60s and 70s, we looked at school systems and we realized that girls had fallen way behind boys. And in part because of the feminist movement really advocating for our girls, and in part because of the research that came out, school districts, aided by a huge grant from the federal government, began to change the way that we do education. And I don't know if they did this based on science or just did it intuitively, but they began to change the way that we do education to make it more girl-friendly, for lack of a better word. Well, what happened was, and part of what happened was it became more verbal. Increasingly, things like recess that boys really need have been phased out of schools. In 1982, girls caught up to boys and then flew by boys. And boys now are not just a little bit behind, they are drastically behind girls in every area of school, from preschool through graduate school. The overwhelming majority of people who get honors are girls. 70% of D's and F's are given to boys, but only 40% of the A's are given to boys. 85% of all Ritalin-like drugs prescribed in the world, 85% of those drugs prescribed in the world are given to our boys in the United States of America.
Oh my goodness.
And so what we've done is we've created a system that tends to favor the way that most girls learn, which is sitting, being verbal, being emotive. And because boys don't do that well, because they're testosterone charged, we can't get them really to figure out how to do this kind of school system, and so we drug them up. Now, there are some boys and girls who need Ritalin. I've got a granddaughter and I've got a grandson who are on that kind of medication, and they absolutely have to have it. It's been a lifesaver. But to say that that many boys in our country need this is not a boy problem. It's a systems problem, kind of like what we're talking about with racism.
Right. I was hearing that.
So, you know, I don't think, for one thing, the over 90% of all elementary school teachers are female. So, of course, they're teaching as they would learn and as they prefer to learn. I don't think female teachers are waking up in the morning thinking, how can I screw up a boy's education today? They just haven't been trained in the brain science. And so part of what's happened now is, and another underreported story, most universities have reached the tipping point where 60 to 70% of the students are female. The rest are male, and a lot of those males are dropping out. And as a result, young adult women now make more money than young adult men, even though you're still going to hear on news that for every dollar a man makes, a woman makes 80 cents. That's never been true. That's never been true. If it's ever been an inequity, it's been pennies. But when you look at the kinds of jobs that men have done, particularly the risks that they do, and that 90% of all job-related deaths are men are going to probably be in higher paying jobs because of the risk that women tend not to go into. Now, again, I'm generalizing. The other reason why women are making more money than men, young adult women, is because they're better educated now. They're the ones who are getting 60, 70% of the doctorates and the master's degrees, not men. And because a lot of the work that men tended to do, which was work with their hands and manufacturing and labor, are disappearing as we move to an information world. So what we still hear in our world is that our girls are behind. And I'm not saying we don't need to do work for our girls. We do. But one example we hear is, well, they're behind in STEM. Well, there's a 3% gap between boys and girls in STEM. Boys are 3% ahead of girls. There is a 6% gap in literacy, with girls 6% ahead of boys. Nobody's talking about that. Because we still live in a world that says our girls they're still in trouble. We still need to fight hard for them. Yeah, we need to do it. It's not an either or story. What happened was it became a right focus on our girls for a while, and we forgot about our boys. And we're reaping a lot of the benefits of that now in a negative way. When boys are undereducated, when they can't get jobs, they either tune out, so they live in their, it's the stereotypical 30-year-old boy right? Living in his parents' basement playing video games. Or it's the overly aggressive, overly angry young adult man. And so what Michael and I are trying to do, not only in talking about girls, but to alert men and women that our boys need our help as well. And that we need to rethink how we do education. We can make some real easy tweaks. And all the research says if you make if you add in some boy-friendly things into your schools, girls will still do better. Because a girl's brain is wired in such a way that she can adapt, where boys, they just don't adapt as well. So here's an example. If you're in a verbal emotive world and you ask a boy, how are you feeling? A girl can almost immediately access words to her emotions because her brain has cross-wiring to both sides, to words and emotions. A boy doesn't. So if you ask a boy, how are you feeling? It can take him anywhere from 30 minutes to 3 to 4 days to answer that question.
Wow.
Well, you know, imagine how freeing that is for wives or daughters or school teachers to hear that boys can't access that as well. So rather than saying, how are you feeling? Ask a boy, what are you thinking right now? Or have them write it down first, do an action first, or throw them a ball. And while you're throwing the ball back and forth or going out for a walk, you talk. That's when boys start to get verbal. Boys just don't automatically, not all boys. I'm a verbal guy. I make my living with words. But the average boy doesn't. And so anyway, there's just so many things that we need to learn. And this is all brain science. The problem for a lot of people is we get caught up in ideologies rather than science. And the ideologies are you know, that you know, boys have privilege, which, you know, there was male privilege, but they don't have that privilege anymore. And so there are systems in place that we need to be aware of to help our boys succeed. And whenever I'm with Gurian and we do these things for educators, almost always, not always, but almost always, they're mostly female teachers because that's who is in the education system for elementary school. And almost all of them are gobsmacked, and no wonder I can't get my boys to respond to me. And so they're not threatened by it, but they just had so many years of, this is how we teach, and our girls are behind, we've got to focus on them. And yet all the teachers know the boys are the ones who are really struggling in school. One more example, and then I'll let you go to the next thing, or we go. But I went last, when we still used to go to have kids in school, my granddaughter, Clover, you know Clover,
yes.
She won an award for citizenship. And each grade awarded 2 or 3 kids per class. And these were all what we call character qualities. Listens well, is polite, you know, all those things. And before it started, I turned to Jan. I said, I'll bet you anything, twice as many girls get that than boys. And it was spot on, twice as many girls, because they were all quiet behavior things. So then we went to Judah's class because he was getting an award. Same thing. I said, I'll bet. And sure enough, spot on, twice as many girls excelled in those character qualities because they are qualities that girls' brains are better wired to do, to sit quietly, to use their words, you know, to listen to the teachers, whatever they might be. And they just don't favor boys, you know. So maybe we need some character qualities. Has a lot of energy. Is really great running around the field. You know, and boys start getting caught up again. And girls can do that, but boys, really, that's their DNA.
You know, we hear often about toxic masculinity. How does that play into all of this?
Well, that's another one of those really sticky, controversial ideologies. I think it's really dangerous to label masculinity as toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Because what that tells our boys or even our young men or our men is you're toxic. There's something wrong with you. You're flawed. And that's just not the case. I've done this when I've done these seminars with Gurian, and I'll say, all right, I want all of you moms who have sons, raise your hands right now if you're raising a toxic son. Well, not one hand is raised.
Mm.
Right? Nobody's out to... There are toxic men, but masculinity in and of itself isn't toxic. Masculinity is noble. Masculinity is is this energy that was created in us, to use religious language, so that men could build a better world. But for men to be able to use that energy, they need to be mentored by other good men and good women to use that energy appropriately, or they can become toxic. But I, you know, there are toxic women out there.
Indeed.
Right? So, but we don't talk about toxic femininity, but there are abusive wives, there are abusive moms. You know, we've had the stories here of the elementary school teachers, the women who've basically raped little kids. That's toxic. So I know there are, from ideology standpoint, there are some people just want to say we have to use toxic masculinity to make a point. I just don't think it makes, I think it makes the wrong point. I think what we need to talk about is toxic actions, men who are toxic. But to label a whole sex as toxic does more damage than good. And then it makes it hard for boys or for young men to figure out, well, all right, if I'm toxic, what about me is toxic and what isn't?
Right.
Is the fact that I'm breathing right now, is that toxic? Is the fact that I want to open a car door for a woman, is that toxic? You know, we just don't know. And so, you know, that adds on another layer for boys who just right now are lost anyway.
Sure.
And so I get it. You know, I'm as angry as the next person about guys. Well, I don't even call them men. They're people masquerading as men, and they're predators. They're evil, whatever you want to call them. They're not really men. A man is a guy who wants to serve his family, who wants to serve his community. That's a man. That's masculinity. Anything short of that is not a man. So I get the word. I understand the word. It just seems to me to be a bit unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I asked. I mean, that's such a wise look in through a window that I don't think we immediately think to look into of what we're even saying about something that we want to see so differently, that yet the label itself is locking us down in something that we are wishing to change.
Well, and think about all these young girls who are, all they hear is toxic masculinity. And then as they're starting to date, toxic masculinity. Well, what kind of view are they going to have of the boys that they're dating? It just doesn't create a better world. It identifies the problem by creating more problems rather than getting at the real problem. And these are men who were never taught how to be good men.
You know, we've hit some really big things, and which I love. I don't think you're messing around, and I'm not either. At the end of the day, we know that it, particularly right now in our world and our country, that there has to be a plethora of things that keep people awake at night, that stir in them. And even those of us who have faith and place our faith in the creator of the universe have to go to bed at night stirred. What stirs you proverbially keeps you up at night?
Well, in the last 3 months, I've had COVID-19 about 16 times. So, you know, every time I sneeze or cough, I've got COVID. This is not a great world for hypochondriacs. I think for me, I'm really fortunate in that Jan and I love hanging out with each other. We tend to be introverted that way. We don't mind being home. Mm-hmm. We're always sitting 6 feet apart. So, you know, it's all social distancing. We wear our masks. All that stuff. So we're fortunate in that. And we are fortunate in that we have the technology to be able to do the live stream with our kids and our grandkids. And I still have my job. My job has, you know, I'm probably busier now than what I was when we were open on a campus.
Sure.
So I'm really fortunate in all of that. I think... what keeps me up at night is just where are we headed as people in the United States of America? What does it mean to be kind and compassionate people? To have the kind of vitriolic fights we're having over masks? among Christian people. It frustrates me. It disappoints me. I don't understand Christian people saying my rights are being violated. Because when you sign up to follow Jesus, you give up your rights.
Wow.
And you take up the right to love your neighbor as you love yourself. That's Whoa. Your right.
Say that one more time. I have chills all over me. Because you know that people are listening that are not followers of Jesus. And right. that they have. There's a lot of conflict even absorbing that for very good reason. Yep. Say that one more time.
When you sign up to follow Jesus, you give up your rights. And you take up the right to love your neighbors, you love yourself.
Hmm.
And so all these discussions about, it's my right to open up my church building. It's my right not to wear a mask. No, not as a Christian anyway. It's your right to protect your neighbor. And the Christian church really took off in terms of a worldwide religion when Rome was going through a pandemic. And people were dying from it by the thousands. And the rich people and the doctors, they all fled. And it was the Christian people who went in at the risk of their lives, cared for the sick. Many Christians died as a result of caring for the sick. And when people saw that, they said, boy, those people, there's something about those people we need to learn more about. Well, now the way that we serve is to get out of the way of our frontline people. And to do what we can to not spread this disease so that we don't overwhelm our hospitals, which we're doing right now in Arizona. Because we all think we have the right to go out and do whatever we want to do. And it's our frontline workers who are paying the price of my rights. And that's not what it means, I don't think, to be a Christian, number one, or to be an American. To be an American says, I lay aside sometimes my rights for the sake of other people. And those are the things that I don't Facebook about it. I guess it's just not worth it. But those are the things that frustrate me. Where are we headed? Some of the decisions that many of our leaders are making, I just scratch my head. One thing I do know is grace will always have the final word.
Mm.
And life and hope will always have the final word. None of us have been here before, but the world has been here before. And what will we learn from it? How will we be better? How will we learn to love our neighbors? How will we learn to fight for equality? All of these things. And I wouldn't say they keep me up at night, but those are the things that I certainly think about throughout the day when I'm reading the news and wanting to throw my iPad across the room. And
sure. And that's what I meant, you know. Because you are so eloquent and you do use less words than me always. As we come to a close here, you said grace will always win. Will you leave those that are listening with an understanding of that, should they not have one? And then just as a reminder to those who do have an understanding of that, how to refresh that in our lives.
So for too long, people have assumed that God is angry with us and that God wants to punish us. And it's sort of the turn or burn crowd. Turn from your sin or roast in hell for eternity. And that's not who God is like at all, at least according to Jesus. The God that Jesus came to proclaim is a God who always and only forgives, who always and only accepts us, just as we are. Who doesn't ask us to clean ourselves up first,
mm-hmm.
who runs to us, doesn't wait for us to run to God, who runs to us and sometimes just bowls us over with love, sometimes it's just really quiet, but whispers in our ear somehow in some way, you're mine, you're valuable to me, I believe in you, and I love you, period. No questions asked. And it's that kind of grace and love that ultimately defeats brokenness and heartache and inequality and oppression. It's that kind of grace that moves us to serve other people so we keep them safe. Imagine a world where rather than the first question is, How can I protect my own rights? What if everybody woke up tomorrow and said, what do I need to do to protect my neighbor tomorrow? Mm. That'd be a whole different world.
Yes.
And that's what grace calls us to. It's not something that we do on our own. That's got to be a transformation that takes place in our heart. Our natural tendency isn't to always be gracious. And obviously, even Christian people who believe in grace don't model that all the time. But grace is just this God who loves us passionately and lavishly and who keeps running after us and won't give up on us and has all of eternity to prove to us that he's a God who loves us and he's on our side.
I love you, my friend.
Love you too, Terrence.
Terry. I thank you so much for spending time, and you are, yep. You're just a smarty pants in the best way I could say that. And, yet filled with, compassion and understanding. And that's, I think an ideal vessel is someone who really has things together up here in the noggin and wanting to learn as well as a heart to deliver. So I will ask you to come back if you would, because you're awesome, and talk more about all that we've talked about and other things. But I thank you for this time so much. Exactly. And it's been a joy and so informative. You're a good man, Charlie Brown.
Thank you, Terry. Love you too.
Well, there you go. What'd I tell you? He is a smarty pants, and he is such a great communicator. I want to give you some direction as to where you can go if you'd like to hear more of his communicating in the facets that he has. You can find him on wonderofparenting.com as well as timwrightministries.org. He spells his last name Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, timwrightministries.org. He also has a book you might want to search for called Searching for Tom Sawyer, How Parents and Congregations Can Stop the Exodus of Boys from Church. He's a great guy. I will have him back. I thank you again for listening. I do hope that you will subscribe, share, and give me some reviews. Also, if you have any questions for me, I'm open to questions always. I will be periodically doing episodes answering your questions. So it's your chance to ask me, folks, if you wanna. Don't hesitate. Go to terrysummers.com/podcast. The spelling of my name is TerrySummers.com/podcast. I thank you. Have a great day. And I look forward to you visiting us on the next episode of the Terry Summers Podcast.